everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Today on the show, we've got the one and only Lisa Huff. We talk to Lisa about her work in energy markets. We touch on parenting. She gives a great hot take at the end. This was an absolute pleasure having her on. I really think you're going to enjoy this one. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Lisa with me. Lisa, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Hi everybody.
I'm looking forward to this. As I told you, I spoke with your daughter, Ella, just a couple weeks ago. Her podcast just went live, and it was a very fun conversation. And so I actually want to start there. So Ella and I talked a lot about her upbringing because I have three small kids. So it's very interesting to me to sort of understand the child perspective, especially when parents have done an excellent job. But I think this is an important topic because I think in the coming couple of decades, Bitcoiners are going to have a lot of financial influence in the world, and how we raise the next generation, I think, matters even more so perhaps than it has historically. So I guess my broad question to you is just, could you sort of frame your approach to parenting and what you did and what were you really intentional about doing with Ella?
I think we were pretty intentional with just about everything, but maybe in a way that is flipped upside down from how a lot of people think about intentionality. Our intention was to give her as much power as possible from the earliest moment possible. So letting her make decisions, letting her get used to having choices, having say. When your kids are small, you start with the, do you want to wear this or do you want to wear this, right? But then it becomes, you pick them up from school and it's, do you want to do your homework first or should we start dinner and set the table? It moves to things like that. And then it progresses to, mom, I think I may want to go to summer camp. Oh, okay. You want to go to summer camp? What does that entail? And she was eight or nine when she went to summer camp for the first time. And that was about 40 forms and signatures and checks. And you got to mail that stuff. And so I said to her, you need to run this exercise. So you need to go online and print the forms and fill them out and get everything organized and then bring it to me and I will sign it and bring me my checkbook. You write the check and then I will sign the check.
Yeah. So just like autonomy.
You will take it to the mailbox. And then it came time to pack for camp. And I said, okay, we're going to do one trip to Walmart or whatever for items. So you need to make a list and then take inventory of what you have so that we don't buy what we don't need. And then you will pack your trunk. And I didn't deliver it like in this sort of mean sort. Maybe I sound, strict or stern or something. I didn't deliver it that way. It was more like, okay, great. I will totally support this effort, but I need for you to do this job, right? And I always really framed for her, here's the list of all the things I do in a day, and here's the list of everything your dad does in a day. And so, when you want to do things, you need to put the things you want to do on your list and make them happen. And what that really led to was a kid that when she went to boarding school in high school, she did all of the research. She did all of the applications. She submitted everything on her own and then rinse and repeat for college. I mean, I have friends who still are saying, oh, we're working on our college applications, or, oh, so-and-so kid won't get the whatever done for college. And, they want to live off campus, but we told them they have to live on campus. And now they've let the deadline for on-campus housing go. And I was never mad at Ella, or I wouldn't be mad at that kid, right? I would just say, we told you that we would pay for on-campus housing and you decided to let the deadline pass. And so now that you're going to have to live off campus, you're also going to be responsible for paying for that. And a child of mine would have been able to, because from the time Ella was like 14, she had a job. So, you know, that's the other thing. It's like, there's no free ride. I'm not supporting you after college. I'm not paying for, you know, just ancillary garbage that we all want along the way, right? Like, happy for you to have ancillary garbage, but you need to go find a way to pay for it. And again, like, Ella was just super receptive and easy. And I will say, more than anything, when you parent like that, it is the ultimate vote of confidence in your child, right? You are saying, I love you, I trust you, you make good decisions, right? And then when they are successful, you can say, oh my gosh, look what you've done, and like, mean it, right? I think parents often say that, oh, look what you've done, you've worked so hard. And the kid really may or may not have worked hard. But, you know, kids need to earn their success. And when they have failures, those are great. You know, I've had, as I have said on another podcast, like, a spectacular failure that happened in front of Ella. And I was okay with that then, and I'm okay with it now, because when she's an adult and has a spectacular failure, it's like, that's just part of it, right? It's, your life isn't over when you have a spectacular failure. Something doesn't go according to plan, or it's so, just, you know, be real with kids. Just have real conversations. You know, we sat down with Ella when she was, I think, 15, maybe. I think she was 15. She opened a Roth IRA and she was working. And so she was depositing her earnings, to, you know, do her contribution to her Roth IRA. And that's when we really started talking about school and college and jobs and where do you want to live after college. I will never forget, she said, I really don't want to work in a job I don't like just because it makes a lot of money. And I said, I totally understand that. That makes perfect sense. So why don't we just talk about what you want your life to look like? So get a, pull up an Excel spreadsheet, which she still has. And I started quizzing her. Where do you want to live? What's your favorite city? Okay, well, I want to live in this city. Okay, so let's look up cost of living for that city. Let's look up a one-bedroom apartment. Let's look up what your bills might be. How are you going to get to work? Will you buy a car? Is there public transportation? How frequently will you go out to eat with your friends? What will your health insurance premium be? What will your car insurance be? How much will you contribute to a savings account when you have said job? And we did this projection to basically try to figure out where she'd land when she retired. Like, do you have enough money to retire at 65 or 62 or whatever it is, and then continue to live for another 30 years? Because in our family, a lot of people have lived to be late 90s. And so when we did that, and we put in all sort of escalation, like, you'll probably change jobs two or three times. And then let's say you change jobs and you get a 50% salary bump. And let's say that you get a raise, you know, you're there for 5 years and you get a 4% raise every year. What does that, we really thought about it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that entire exercise, which probably took an entire weekend, the answer was, wow, I really need to get out and get a good job. And so she was going into high school, or had just started high school, I guess. Maybe she was 14. Maybe she was 14 when we did this. And again, she took the course guide from her boarding school, combed through it, figured out what the highest level math was, and then completely backwards built her 4-year schedule. So this is what I'll take senior year. This is what I'll take junior year. And, you know, really with the plan that she wanted to attend one of the service academies and get an engineering degree. And so what then might she take in college? So then she's on the college websites at 14 or 15, whatever it was. And she's looking at what the college courses are, and then kind of did the same exercise. What do I have to graduate with a degree so that I can get out and get a good job so that I can just live this regular life, right? I mean, the spreadsheet was not buy a summer house, take trips to Europe. The spreadsheet was like, it's just expensive to breathe.
Right.
So having real conversations with your kids that are just like practical, right? This is what it is to be an adult, has turned her into who she is, because she's completely responsible for everything that's happened to her. And I mean, she asks for my advice. Sometimes she actually gets really upset with me, and she'll, you know, because I'll say, well, what are you thinking? Well, what would the other choice be? Well, and she'll be on the phone and she'll just say, Mom, this is one of those times when I really just want to know what you think.
That's funny. It's it seems like there are sort of two principles that I pull out of everything you just said. One of them, especially at a young age, is patience. So I have three kids, and you know, like they want to take ownership of things, right? They want to do things. They want to help. They want to be, you know, useful. And it's so easy for, it's way quicker if I do it, right? You know, or their mom does it. And it's a bad habit that you have to break, that like the goal is, and the second principle is like, you're raising an adult, right? You're not raising a child. You're raising someone into adulthood and to be responsible. And in order to do that, you have to start at the beginning and make the determination that expedience is not the answer to everything, and that having the patience to step back and say, how I respond to even these little things at a young age really impacts them, because they're going to build on that, and they're going to be able to fill out forms and applications and write a check when they're 9 years old, instead of, you know, mom and dad just take care of everything. I just go outside and play and do my homework, and that's it, right? It seems like those are kind of that's what I've gleaned from your comment on raising Ella. And as someone who has multiple kids, it is harder that, like, you know, you're juggling a lot of balls. You've got one kid wanting to do one thing, and you need to get places and dress, you know, multiple people dressed. And but I think it's still important that regardless of where you are, to step back and make sure that the decisions that you're making today are informing the way that they are going to be living a few years from now, and then a few years later, and into adulthood. So I absolutely love that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I obviously I only have Ella, and so probably should not be giving advice on raising multiple children. But I think my approach to that would be to really reflect on who runs a great team that I admire. Right. Like, I would probably, who was the coach at Notre Dame for so long? The old guy.
I'm blanking on his name.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I know who you're talking about, though.
I would probably do a deep dive on people like that and how they ran teams, because you know that people that run great teams are all about helping the team build from within, right? It's not a top down. And, you know, so what? It takes longer to do stuff. So what? Like, it should take longer. And, you know, also, I was just heavy on praise. I never told her when she did something wrong. But if she did something right, or not right, it really wasn't right or wrong, but I mean, she had a lot of responsibility in our house from the very beginning. I mean, she was like setting the table at 3 or 4 years old, right? And she'd fold the napkin and everything would be really pretty. And I'd say, oh my gosh, this looks so pretty. I can't wait to sit down here with you tonight. You know, I can't wait till dad gets home and we have dinner. And right, just rewarding them and noticing their work. it's like a, then they repeat it, right? They really, when they're little, they really want to please you. Mm-hmm. They really don't want you to be upset. And, you know, we always also spoke to Ella like an adult. I mean, you know, if she were upstairs and I was downstairs, I would go to the bottom of the stairs and I would call up the stairs at her and I'd say, "Excuse me, Ella." And she'd come to the top of the stairs and she'd say, "Yes, mommy." Like, it was never, "Ella, come down here," you know, which is sort of the household I grew up in. I just decided that was not, it's just really factually, it wasn't the house I wanted to live in. It really wasn't that I gave all this thought to, oh, I want to raise a respectful child. It was simply, that's not the house I want to live in. And, you know, we carpooled with some families for a while and it really became more stress than it was worth because, you know, those parents, those kids, like people are frazzled at 6:45 in the morning during pickup. And I just don't want frazzled in my life, like, especially at 6:45 or 7 in the morning. So we stopped carpooling and it was just like, you know, how to preserve the peace, right? Create a peaceful household for your kids.
Yeah. I love that. I love it. All right. Let's talk a bit about Bitcoin. So I believe you started your career in natural gas trading, energy markets. How did you find Bitcoin? What was the, because it's an interesting, plug, you know, into Bitcoin mining these days, but I assume there was something else that led you into this, this wild world of the Bitcoin rabbit hole.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I got my first job trading, I answered an ad in the physical Houston Chronicle newspaper, right? I was looking through the job section and I put my resume, you know, on beautiful Crane ecru paper and a beautiful, you know, big envelope and did the label on my printer and, you know, mailed it off. Unfortunately, working in Bitcoin doesn't normally quite tumble out that way. But I just started looking at, you know, building a different investment portfolio than the one that I had kind of in 2017, 2018, 2019. Somewhere in there, I stumbled upon the MIT Tech Review magazine, and they had a list of the top 50 technologies of the year from, I think, 2010 to 2017. They published that list. And I just started looking at all of those technologies, and somewhere, you know, I heard blockchain. And so I asked Google, how do I buy blockchain? And then that started me down the crypto rabbit hole. And then I started trading crypto because, don't forget, legitimately, I was a commodities trader, right? So I'm telling myself, like, oh, this is totally normal. I'll trade all these altcoins. And I woke up in the middle of the night on a trip in this beautiful place. And I realized that I'm like up for 2 hours trading on my Coinbase app these cryptos. And I don't know, like the next morning I just said, you know what, I'm done with this. Like, and I don't remember, I mean, I don't think I lost any money. I think I was actually, I know I was doing well because I was, that's what was paying my bills. But I just knew I didn't want to live that way. It wasn't that I had taken the orange pill. It wasn't that I had seen that, you know, Bitcoin is divine or Bitcoin is this huge signal. Like, there was no blinking orange light. I just simply didn't want to live in the frazzled world. Again, how do I de-stress? How do I live in a peaceful place without looking at my Schwab app or my Coinbase app or checking the earnings of Amazon or whatever it was I was doing? I just didn't want to live that way anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I decided I understood Bitcoin, which I'm sure I didn't. But I knew it was a scarce asset and that was good enough for me. And I think, you know, if people take nothing from a conversation, a brand new conversation about Bitcoin. Like, scarcity is value. Scarcity drives value. And over time, scarce assets become the most valuable assets. And so that's really where I started with Bitcoin. And then just, you know, kind of started preaching the gospel. I actually spun up a consulting deck at the sort of suggestion, at the real suggestion of one of my friends said, you know, gosh, you talk about Bitcoin all the time. You should teach people Bitcoin. So I spun up a consulting deck and I started telling people I was an expert in Bitcoin, which I was not. But I knew a lot more than they did.
Right.
And so I started working with family offices and energy companies. I worked with two public energy companies and just kind of helped them understand that Bitcoin mining was something they should be looking at, and that, you know, deprogram yourself from the malware that the legacy media, which it appears is crumbling in front of our eyes right now, thank God. You know, you had to deprogram the malware that the legacy media and the evils of Elizabeth Warren have put in your brain, because none of that's correct. And then I went to work for Parker Lewis at Unchained. I met Parker at a conference. I would say conferences are the best way to get involved in the Bitcoin space. If you want to work in Bitcoin, you need to be going to Bitcoin conferences. And you need to be meeting people in real life. I get a lot of people that reach out on LinkedIn, which I'm super happy to do a 20-minute meeting. You know, if somebody wants to, how do I work in Bitcoin? It's like, start coming to Bitcoin stuff.
Yeah, that's where everyone is.
Yeah. And then that, you know, turned into other Bitcoin opportunity and, you know, like working with Caitlin Long, which was great. Unfortunate that the timing of Custodia was during the reign of Elizabeth Warren and her cronies and choke point, you know, 999.9.
Well, that was actually, so Custodia is something I was going to ask you about. And I mean, maybe you could just talk briefly about what you did there, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the notion of Bitcoin banks in general. Or my guess is we probably agree on fractional reserve banking and that sort of thing, or at least the potential issues with it. But there's been a lot of buzz about Michael Saylor talking about Bitcoin banks. There are a lot of people who seem to think that this is, you know, necessary, essential, some people who are completely opposed. I'd be curious to hear, so again, what you did at Custodia, and then maybe how that's shaped or evolved your opinions on Bitcoin banks, maybe more specifically.
Yeah, at Custodia, I think my title was Vice President of Strategic Relationships, which meant that I got to have conversations with incredible people and with the aim of serving them, right? You want to be of service when you are a financial institution and you're building a Bitcoin financial institution. The goal is to serve Bitcoin financial, you know, Bitcoin companies, right, that need financial services. So we worked with public miners, we worked with pensions, foundations. Custodia was institutional only or business only, so no retail customers, no me and you. But I helped understand what those businesses were looking to do, right? Were they looking for treasury management? Were they looking for Bitcoin custody? were they looking for... you know, whatever, how could we be of service to them? What partnerships were kind of on the potential roadmap where really the customer's interest lie? That was probably the most fun, was hearing how they wanted to build out their business and how we could be helpful. You know, what infrastructure would be helpful for them? So, you know, again, it's unfortunate that lawsuit against the Federal Reserve ended the way that it did. I think they're appealing it. I'm really not up to date on Custodia, but she's certainly Caitlin is certainly a visionary, and it was a great it is a great group of people that participated in Qustodia. As for your question on Bitcoin banking, I mean, again, Michael, you might have this sense already. Like, I just want peace in my life. I don't really think about it. I don't think about what happens to the traditional banks or how they integrate into the Bitcoin world. Maybe I should spend more time thinking about it. I don't. I really don't care.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair answer, because I think a lot of what's likely to play out is just an inevitability. And I don't know exactly what all of those inevitabilities are, but it's like Wall Street coming in to, you know, the ETFs coming online and, you know, some of these banks that are now receiving, you know, approval to custody Bitcoin. It's nation state adoption. You know, it's not really a matter of what we want or what we individually think is optimal, but when the right person in the right position begins to appreciate Bitcoin for what it is, I think there's just going to be adoption at whatever level that is. And
And I think the financialization of Bitcoin, I think different products around Bitcoin make a lot of sense for participants in the market. And that's generally, it's generally good for markets. I've seen that happen in the natural gas world. I worked on a developing derivatives desk at Enron, and it was hugely impactful to the overall market. So I'm really interested in how the hash rate derivatives develop within Bitcoin and other financial products. I think people are looking for yield on their Bitcoin, and maybe that sort of notion is misunderstood in some ways by retail. But I think that the banks will participate. There's no way that the market cap of Bitcoin continues to grow exponentially and the banks aren't participants, right? Yeah. I mean, they're just like me when I got into Bitcoin. They're greedy. I was greedy. They have a duty to their shareholders to perform. And so when they see that this is the best performing asset of all time and more people are allocating resources to this, I mean, in my opinion, they have an obligation to serve their shareholders. It seems as though some legislation perhaps would be appropriate. Now banks are not able to custody Bitcoin, but I see that changing. I think that the new administration will really bring us forward into a better time in America and a more supportive ecosystem. Bitcoin is here. It's not going away. And so supporting the build out of infrastructure, whether it's hard infrastructure, it's concrete, it's buildings, it's miners, you know, physical hardware, or it's derivative products or custody products. I mean, it's all good for Bitcoin.
Yeah, or legislative victories, right? I mean, there's so many ways this could go. What I've been thinking about with the new administration, it, like, my position is happy with the result, cautiously optimistic about what really gets done, because I've seen politicians for long enough to know that what's promised is not always delivered. But what I'm curious to see is, you can't kill Bitcoin, but you can cause problems for it. You can slow its rate of adoption. You can scare institutions out of, you know, putting it on their balance sheet or make it difficult or whatever. I'm wondering if over the next 4 years, even if nothing happens, so to speak, even if there's no like pro Bitcoin, pro crypto agenda going on in DC, if just leaving it alone, where we have 4 years of uninterrupted ability to build and grow organically, if that alone might make it effectively impossible after those 4 years to try to rein it back in, right? Like, if banks just have the ability to start custodying Bitcoin, if institutions are no longer scared about what the implications of having Bitcoin on their balance sheet might be, if it's just there, you know, it's at some point there's no turning back, no matter what you want to do 4 years from now, it's too late, it's too integrated into our lives. That's, to me, if that's all that happens, like, that would be a huge win. And again, it's not that my hope would be that retail, that Wall Street stays out for as long as possible and retail investors get the first chance. There's so many people in my life I'd love to adopt Bitcoin who haven't. But you know, it's, that's their decision to make. My sense is that's not the direction we're headed. And my hope is if I can't have my first desire of retail just continuing to win and front run Wall Street and nation states, it's that if it's inevitable that they're going to adopt, that it happens rather quickly and in a significant way, so as to prevent further disruption, I guess, to our progress into the future. I'm curious if you think that's maybe what a Trump administration could potentially provide for us.
Well, it certainly looks to me like all signs are not neutral on Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. Certainly looks like there's an acceleration of adoption within Washington. Sorry, I was actually told last night not to refer to Washington as Washington, but to call it DC. I told this by someone from Washington State, but I've never mentioned that to me before. So
it seems DC. Like, you call it the swamp too.
It seems DC. Like DC is, there might be people that are very friendly that are moving into DC, but I think it's really a more grave place, grave moment in time than most realize. It isn't just, I want my family to buy Bitcoin, right? It's, we need Bitcoin mining in the United States. We need that compute power. We need that hash rate. We need that block space here in the United States, in the same way that we need onshore, you know, or domestic energy production. We need to keep bringing hydrocarbons out of the ground. We need to keep growing our energy infrastructure. Both things are key facets of our national security. It is not understood widely or not discussed widely that if Bitcoin is the underpinning of all information transfer, maybe it's 10 years out, 20 years out, maybe it's 5 years out. I mean, I think Bitcoin is the first use case, that the asset Bitcoin is the first use case that we're seeing play out. And even if it's only that, if it's the underpinning of the financial system of the future, and we don't have hash rate in the United States of America, we could be sanctioning ourselves from using the future financial system. Because yes, we might have strong alliances with other nations who could process transactions for us, but we also may not. You know, we've seen 36 countries stand together, take a picture, flip their middle finger at the United States. You know, they're basically establishing new trade routes. Right there, that's what they're putting in place, is new trade routes, and they're figuring out how to support those trade routes, whether it's creation of a new currency. I personally think that they'll begin using Bitcoin. I mean, maybe they create BRICS and it's the token of choice that they want to exchange, like prisoners exchange cigarettes. Maybe they want to exchange the BRICS token. But for all, you know, nation state level, big, perhaps it's only year in, but I mean, they will use Bitcoin. I actually think within the year, Russia will start accepting crude oil or Bitcoin for their crude oil, natural gas, their natural resources. I think it just makes sense. There's no reason why you would go to there's no reason why they should accept the Indian currency, the Chinese currency, the American currency, and then have FX risk, and then have counterparty risk and bank risk. And, you know, if they've learned nothing from us sanctioning their assets as they went into Ukraine, they certainly understand how critical it is to have financial infrastructure within your own borders. And when we sanctioned them, you know, they wisely with vision increase their hash rate in their country. Russia is the second largest producer of natural gas in the world. So, wow, I can't sell this into the dollarized world. Huh. Let's coordinate a ton of capital and let's build out Bitcoin mining in Russia. I mean, we knew there already was some, but they announced recently, in the last few months, that they mined one out of every five Bitcoin in 2023.
Wow. Wow.
So, you know, the other thing of note, I would point people back to when the Trans-Siberian pipeline was being built. That was in the early 80s. That pipeline originated in Russia and it went 2,600 miles into Europe. We asked, so let's take you back. This is during the Cold War, right? Or in that era of the Cold War. And we went to our allies, France and Germany and others, and said, do not support any of this construction. Do not support Russia in any form or fashion with this project. And the US did that because we did not want Russia to be able to monetize their natural resources. Right, we didn't want them to be able to transport through a pipeline and then get paid by our European allies, because then presumably they could, have more money to pour into their military efforts. But do you know what our allies said? They said, "Stuff it. Our energy security comes before your political agenda."
I think a lot of these alliances are sort of taken for granted, you know, and we've seen such a shift just in the last 20 years. And I mean, the growth of BRICS is, for me, that's been eye-opening, because it's something I take for granted who our allies are. But to project yourself out 20 or 30 years and to imagine that the world could look very different, I think is important. Your comment on Russia accepting Bitcoin for its resources is another interesting observation or prediction. I guess it's, for me, it's sort of an interesting thing, because on one hand, if you do that, then you remove all that counterparty risk and you don't have to wonder who your allies are 10, 20, 30 years from now. And I think that's the big win for any country willing to be visionary enough to accept Bitcoin or to make it legal tender. I think the drawback of that is you begin to reduce the credibility of your own central bank and ability to manipulate, money supply. And so, on one hand, if you are the earliest adopter on the nation state level, you have a massive advantage. But over a long enough time horizon, that advantage begins to diminish to some degree, because let's say we just take the conventional wisdom that Putin is a strong man and he rules Russia with an iron fist. If he loses the ability to control and manipulate the money, that's a lot to lose, you know, during his lifetime. But if he genuinely cares about Russia's future and its prosperity when he's gone, then adopting Bitcoin makes a lot of sense. Could your thesis be upended by just the selfishness of politicians and the desire to continue having control over a money printer and the ability to manipulate currency, or are you pretty convinced that nation states someone's going to start adopting Bitcoin because they just want to remove the counterparty risk and not have to guess who their allies are?
I would take a different tact. Currency is not money.
Fair.
Over, time, many things have been used as money. They've all been what at the time was scarce, right? Whether that's the glass beads or those huge rocks or gold. Currency is, an easily tradable second layer of money. And that could be circumstance dependent. If there's a hurricane that's hit Houston and, you know, I want to preserve my food and I need ice, I might trade 9mm ammo for ice. If I'm in prison, maybe it's cigarettes for something, right? That is the function of currency. But currency is not wealth. And the distinction between what money is and what a currency is, what a monetary unit is and what currency is one that people really should investigate. I think that's where we really got off track. And this week, Robbie Michnick at BlackRock issued a statement that said BlackRock sees Bitcoin as a viable monetary asset, or something like that, but as a monetary asset. Mm-hmm. He didn't call it the best cryptocurrency. He didn't call it a currency. He called it a monetary asset. And that's the key. That's what it is. People really need to wake up and understand that the central banks are going to be forced to hold Bitcoin. Right? They've been in mass destruction mode. And this is really their only way out. Or, I mean, they have a couple of ways out, but like, this is really the only way it all ends well. Mm-hmm. And we're already seeing that, right? We're seeing nations put this on their balance sheet. We're seeing sovereigns put this on their balance sheet. And also we're seeing them set up huge mining operations, right? Why would you not want to take any resource that you have and turn it into the most valuable resource? So if you're the US, you know, Cynthia Lummis is now saying, let's sell all of the gold in the US, or let's sell a portion of the gold in the US and let's buy Bitcoin. You know, also we're printing money to send to places all over the world for things that we don't even know about, right? Like, why not print dollars to buy Bitcoin?
Yeah, a lot of options we have. I think that just the big question is, do the right people understand it at a deep enough level, and can they get the support necessary to make that determination? I'm a little less clear on the mechanism by which we in the United States put Bitcoin on our balance sheet. Is that, you know, an executive order? Is it legislation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not quite sure how they'll end up doing it. I need to probably spend more time on that topic, but it's
do you think it's inevitable in the next 4 years? Do you think there's like a lot of talk about a strategic Bitcoin reserve? Do you think that's happening between now and 2028?
I think it's happening in the next 6 months.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, really, that can happen so quickly. We can take the 200,000 Bitcoin that we've confiscated and transfer it into however they categorize. I mean, I don't know how they categorize it, however they categorize strategic reserves that we hold. I mean, we have strategic reserves for oil. We have it for pharmaceuticals. We have gold, right? This won't be terribly difficult.
Yeah. Do you think they get, so I view, there are sort of two types of strategic reserves that I see. One is we've confiscated a bunch of Bitcoin and we're just going to hold that and call it our strategic reserve. Another is a much more proactive approach to this, where it's like, we're going to keep that and then we're going to buy, or we're going to mine, or we're going to somehow continue to intentionally accumulate more Bitcoin. Do you think, would you say that's coming in the next 6 months, like a proactive means of growing the strategic reserve?
I do. Okay. And I also, you know, think that if we were really smart, we would provide incentives to our existing energy infrastructure owners so that they can set up mining facilities, right? We provide all kinds of incentives for wind and solar, and all that's done is destabilize our grids.
Yeah.
We could provide incredible incentives to existing energy infrastructure owners so that they could create Bitcoin mining on their, you know, within their own assets that would not burden the grid. So that, and that's what my work is. That's what I do, is sit down with asset owners and work with them to set up Bitcoin mining operations. And that takes all forms of, that's an, you know, multifaceted conversation.
Yeah. So, okay. So is this Bitcoin Today Coalition proof of workforce?
No.
This is just
my consulting business.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. So why don't you tell me a little bit about that then? I know you've got, it seems you've got your hands in a lot of things, and most of what you're doing is preaching the gospel of Bitcoin.
I know. I love it.
Oh, it's the best. So tell me about those conversations you have as a consultant. Who are you talking to? And I'm always really curious how you lead that conversation and what the reception is.
Well, I've been doing it since 2020, and the reception was not as warm. But now a lot of those, you know, hooks I've put in the water, those people are calling me. What was that you were talking about? Explain how a midstream asset can benefit. So it could take the form of an investment bank putting me in touch with one of their clients, which actually happened this week. A banker for a very large private energy company. I met him a few weeks ago at a cocktail party, and he was telling me about his business and a transaction they were working on. And I just said, have you guys considered Bitcoin mining within any of that infrastructure? And it started down the road. And this week, I was in that energy company's office with their executive team. And after 45 minutes, it was clear their enthusiasm is very high. And, you know, the energy guys, I think, are the smartest people on earth, right? They're extracting natural resources from 1,000 feet down, 10,000 feet down, sometimes in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico or the middle of the ocean somewhere. Like, the energy part is the difficult part. The Bitcoin mining is difficult, but it's much easier. It's not, you know, they sometimes have the perception that it's going to be overly difficult, and, you know, helping them to see that it's, you know, to demystify it. And it really just depends also what sort of capital they have. So in this instance, they have a lot of capital of their own to deploy. And that's, it seems like that's where their interest lies. But within other organizations, it might be helping to introduce them to a Bitcoin miner, whether it's a public or a private Bitcoin mining company. And it's really, what I do is I try to align people's interests. So what part of the world is it? What part of the country is it? What's the asset? You know, who might work well together? You know, that's was the great thing about working at Unchained and Custodia, is that I know so many of these wonderful people that run these incredible Bitcoin mining companies. So it's, you know, easy for me to pick up the phone and call them. But, you know, now that I'm really actively engaged in doing this, and I think the word is spreading, you know, two public miners called me this week and said, we'd really like to do a pilot with that type of a group. Will you keep us in mind? Yes, I will. Because again, I think this is a matter of national security, right? This goes way beyond Bitcoin, the asset. And I'm deeply patriotic and have deep connections to the to our military and to our vets, and spent the greater part of last year in a veterans hospital as my dad was dying. And, you know, was there for hours and hours and hours every day and interacting with a lot of the vets that were there. So I care deeply that our country becomes a rich country again. We owe it to the people who have served. We owe it to the kids that are being born. And it's possible, right? So yeah, I think it's absolutely, even the guys at the Federal Reserve can take off the glasses and just quit lying to themselves. If they are, and I'm not saying they are, but you know, I think if you love, who said this? Eric Weinstein, I think said something like, loving your grandchildren or hating, maybe said something like, if you want to live in a world where, you know, the ship is sinking 2% a year, and he's referring to inflation, you must really hate your grandchildren. Hmm. And that's the cold truth.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cause I don't think the only people who like 2% inflation are the people setting that as a target and trying to enforce it. Right. I mean, everyone else has to live with it. And, the Cantillon effect is real. So quick curiosity on some of these, energy companies that you've worked with, when they think on, I imagine some of them are like trying to harness stranded energy or just leverage their infrastructure to mine Bitcoin that they have. Are they doing that? Are they selling the Bitcoin that they mine, or are they adding it to a strategic reserve that they have, or a combination of the two?
Yeah, I don't have a project that's far enough along for them to, there's nobody that's set up today.
Okay.
Imminently.
A lot of work involved. Like, yeah. Well,
just, I mean, an off-grid deployment is, it is a deployment in often remote places with equipment that is, you know, requires a crane, right? These aren't simple. Mm-hmm. Aren't simple exercises. So I don't know what they'll end up doing. I always do tell them though that maybe just start by selling your Bitcoin, right? Maybe get comfortable with the fact that you now can turn your natural gas into dollars instantly. And yes, it'll go through Bitcoin, right? Natural gas powers the generator that runs the Bitcoin mining computer that contributes the hash to the pool, and the pool pays out daily. And maybe they convert to cash daily. Maybe they can convert to the Fed token. You know, I think over time, their conviction will change, and perhaps in the way that they have other assets, they will add Bitcoin as an asset. But yeah, Right now, it's, you know, really helping them just, if they have one commodity or two commodities or three commodities, right, it's adding a fourth. It's adding, you know, view this as I am taking this thing and turning it into something more valuable. And in a lot of cases, I mean, what we're seeing now is that, you know, the guys that have natural gas and they're selling it into these markets, sometimes the market is so constrained that the gas is actually trading negative. But let's just say that you're getting what the print is on CNBC, on the NYMEX, on the Henry Hub, right? Mm-hmm. Let's just say that you're getting sort of an equivalent to that. So you're in the $2 range. Well, what if your realized price by turning it into Bitcoin was $7? Mm-hmm. Who would not do that? You know, I've sat with an offshore company maybe a year ago. I hosted a dinner. I host these dinners for energy companies and really cool people. Had a couple of ambassadors from US to other places come. And it's just, you know, I try and infect everyone in my circle. But we sat around a table at a steakhouse and I said, you know, I see in a not too distant future, you having Bitcoin mining on your rig. And he said, and this is the largest, one of the largest producers in the Gulf of Mexico. And he said, no, I don't think that'll ever happen. You don't understand OSHA, blah, blah, blah. I can't even put a toilet on the rig without OSHA knowing and, you know, permits and this and permits that. And that, I think, will change, you know. And I said that, said it to him then, and I'll say it again, like, why would you put natural gas in a pipeline and send it back to somewhere in the Gulf Coast to get paid $2 when you can get paid $6 or $8 by mining it on your rig, or, you know, use an old drill ship, park it next door to your rig and put, you know, stack containers on that drill ship and mine there. Like, and, mm-hmm. and actually I was with, two chairmen and CEOs of public energy companies last night, and I had this very same conversation, and they were like nodding their head. Makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah. And,
well, so all of that to say, like, pun intended, the tide has shifted.
I love that. And it's funny because I think this may be a point you were sort of making, is that they're coming for the money, and I think over the next few years, they're going to stay for the revolution. So even if they're just selling for dollars to make that difference, eventually you start to go down the rabbit hole. It's like, it's the same journey with everyone. And, you know, maybe they sort of reshape their business, you know, in really significant ways to that, you know, 10 years from now, they view their energy business as a means of producing Bitcoin, you know, and
100%. That's exactly what I think. 100%. I think all energy will be first directed to Bitcoin mining, and energy will be so abundant that, you know, other energy will then have, you know, will then flow back to us, right? There will be no turn your thermostat to 90 to preserve energy. You know, you can only charge your car one day a week, or, I mean, all this garbage that we talk about. We need to have an abundant mindset. This is coming. This is possible. This is great. And to your point, I mean, I think it used to be my pinned tweet. I'm not sure if it is anymore, but there was a clip from Dirty Coin, and I was saying, you know, the energy companies have responsibility to their shareholders. They do. They have responsibility to their shareholders or their stakeholders, first and foremost. And so this is here. It is good for you. It is fun. Like, it's not like eating broccoli or something, right? Like, it's just infectious. Water's warm. Come on in.
Yeah, that's so good. Well, I wish you the best of luck these next few years. And one of the things, I know we're, are you okay for just a couple more minutes? I got one or two more questions for you. Okay. So what I'm curious about is, it's November 22nd, we're sitting at $98,977 Bitcoin. Do you think, we at the Bitcoin Way, we try not to get bogged down in the price action, we don't make predictions, but it seems 100K seems inevitable here soon. Do you think that there's something sort of magic about that new big round number that is going to fundamentally change the conversations you're having, like hitting that milestone where people can no longer ignore it? Do you anticipate delivering the orange pill, or at least making the financial case for Bitcoin? Do you think that's going to be easier over the next year or two?
100%. I mean, the 100,000 number is a huge psychological number.
Yeah.
And it shows that, you know, this either goes to zero or the possibility is, you know, this is infinite, right? The price appreciation, it's going up forever, Laura.
Right.
I had a meeting yesterday with, a guy in the construction industry who's done extremely well. And he just said, you know, I never have bought this. I just don't feel like I understand it. And then he said, but I know that it's not worth 98,000. I know it's either worth zero or it's worth millions. And I just looked at him and I was like, I think you really understand this a lot better than you.
Yeah, yeah. That's amazing. I love it. Yeah, that's been my sense is like just, you know, I think what you're doing is much more profound than anything I'm doing in my personal life. But I have a feeling friends, family, I'll start getting some of those calls at 100,000. Like, okay, I can't ignore this thing anymore. You know, it's just crushing anything my financial advisor's done for me. And I'm hopeful that maybe that's just like that's the blinking orange light to get people's attention again on this. So yeah, I'm excited. All right, I got one more question for you. It's one I ask everyone at the end, and it's, what is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if it offends Bitcoiners?
Well, I mean, I think I've given you two of my unpopular opinions. I don't think it's, maybe, I don't know. Does it have to be specific to Bitcoiners or?
No. I'd say Fidé on the podcast, and his was that he hates movies. So
movies?
Yeah, he thinks they're a waste of time.
I don't know. I try not to be judgmental about what other people do or, I really try to just focus on positive.
What you're doing.
It's really all I've got. You know, it's like, I can't let negative things settle inside you. I just refuse. Like I said, I just spent 11 months watching my dad die. Like, time is precious. You know, I think Russia begins using Bitcoin within the next matter of months. And I think that we are in dire straits if we do not dig into partnerships with our energy companies. Mm. Dire straits. And it's much bigger than number go up. So, I'm not sure a lot of people are yet making the connection to national security, but it is, to me, the most critical piece of Bitcoin infrastructure.
Interesting. I like that. I think it's probably just a perspective or a pulse on what's really going on in energy specifically, and an appreciation for the importance of energy. Most people don't go through their day thinking about how they can flip their lights on or warm their house or, you know, whatever. And I think if anyone has an appreciation for the significance and the scale of that, it's you. And
I will say something that, you know, will tick some people off, and I really don't care. All of this climate conversation, especially on college campuses, I mean, Ella attended a meeting recently, and there were two climate groups there that like actively kind of verbally attacked her for bringing Bitcoin to Cornell. And, you know, Ella is really nice and she's strong, right? But she does not have sharp elbows. She did not work on a trading floor with all men. And I mean, I would have eviscerated those kids. I said to her, here's the question that I would have asked them. Please give me 3 steps in a row of any part of oil is in the ground to you flipping the magic switch right there. Mm-hmm. Give me 3 steps in a row, any part of the process. Give me 3 steps in the production process. Give me 3 steps in the pipeline process. Give me 3 steps in a row, how do the markets work? Explain 3 steps in trading natural gas or crude oil. Give me 3 steps on how a grid works, on how a gas-fired generation asset works. And then you can come back to me and preach your climate bullshit.
Yeah. That is a great point. Nobody, like, I know very little about this world, and I've had to kind of piece things together as I've gone. And I guarantee you, I know 20 times more than a bunch of college kids protesting. And I admittedly know very little. but it's just, it's indoctrination. It's nothing more than indoctrination and fear mongering.
It's really the ultimate irony that you have so many kids who, you know, paid consultants and spent hours on essays and to go to an Ivy League school to then be told what to think. Right? It's like we have lost the plot, because when those schools were first formed, in Cornell especially, it was to give people a place to freely think, to explore new ideas. And they have just lost the plot.
Yeah, it's sad. One of my biggest hopes for Bitcoin is I think it will be such an effective tool for realigning incentives in so many ways. And we've been talking about energy and the incentives there. I think so many things that you can get away with on a fiat standard, and a lot of this climate alarmism, I think, is one example. It's just not optional when you're working with a scarce form of money. And I don't know exactly the mechanism by which it solves many of the things that it will solve, but I think it's going to. You know, you see how it fixes one thing or another. And I just think about like my own, like, you know, I've joked on the podcast before, my wife keeps asking me what Bitcoin needs to hit for us to put in a pool. And I'm like, you realize though, we're not spending our Bitcoin, whatever fiat we have left over, you know, when Bitcoin does its thing, like spending that on the, like, because it changes the way that you view money, and you don't want to give up this scarce asset for something that isn't really, really important. And I think a lot of the incentives around climate science, if you even want to call it that, around education, diet, nutrition, all of these things, I think just change very fundamentally. So that's sort of a tangent, but
yeah,
I think you're hitting on an important broad point here.
Yeah, I would say the way that I think about what to trade Bitcoin for, and when will this come out? Are you going to put this out before Thanksgiving or after?
I think after. I think it'll be maybe the week after Thanksgiving.
Okay. You know, hopefully when people are around their Thanksgiving tables, that this is a very positive conversation, or maybe not a conversation at all. I don't think that force feeding Bitcoin is good for anybody.
Agreed.
But we know about Bitcoin, and I make it my responsibility to know about Bitcoin for my family. And in doing that, you know, when my dad was in hospice, even though he was in the hospital, he didn't have full-time care, right, provided by the Veterans Hospital. That's just not what they do. And my siblings and I were able to coordinate private care for him so that, you know, when I was working, and my sister has an extremely stressful job, she's a ER nurse, and my brother doesn't live in Houston, but we were able to coordinate private care. And, you know, I was not working at Custodia. I have my consulting practice, but I'm not exactly getting rich off of that. And so I was selling Bitcoin to pay those caregivers. And it was a lot. And the Bitcoin will be 100x what I paid those caregivers. And I wouldn't take any of it back. Right? Like me, that was why I owned Bitcoin. I will forever be so grateful that, you know, we collectively could do that for him. I think about owning Bitcoin. I think, you know, I do it for my family. I do it to protect my family and to provide for these situations, which could really be tragic and terrible. Yeah, much more so than what am I trading my Bitcoin for? Do I want a Rolex, or which I actually sold a Rolex to buy Bitcoin, but you know, I mean,
that's right.
So yeah, I really think of it as a long-term solution, and it's protection, right? It's like a shield. It's protection. It allows you to walk to good things, and it allows you to walk away from bad things. So I'm, you know, I just hope everyone, like to your point, catches the bug sooner rather than later. But, you know, the ones that have Bitcoiners in their family, I think, I mean, I certainly can't speak for the Bitcoin community, but I have a feeling that any of us that were in the situation that I was just in would have done exactly the same thing, right? It's like the ultimate use of Bitcoin is taking care of our families.
Yeah, worth every sat. Well, Lisa, I think that is a fantastic place to wrap up. I love it. Why don't you give a handoff? Where can people find you, learn more about you? You've been on a lot of podcasts, I know. So for everyone listening, check anything that Lisa directs you to out.
Yeah, I have a website. You can book time with me on my website. It's lisahuff.io. And I do answer on LinkedIn if you DM me, or Twitter if you DM me. Sometimes it takes me a while because they just get buried. There's a lot of inbound on those two channels, but you can definitely just book directly on my website, reach out. If I can be helpful, I love when people reach out and say, I'm thinking about working in Bitcoin, or how do I do this? Or, and I, you know, I have like all these success stories in Bitcoin with young people who reached out to me and have said, this is what I want to do, or this is what I'm interested in. And you know, they're like little chicklets. I'm like, okay, well, what about, you know, how about you start a Bitcoin club on your university campus? And how about you start putting content out? Or, and one of these guys, there are a bunch of them that are now working at Bitcoin companies, but one of these guys is now working at MicroStrategy. So
very ultimate, cool.
Like flex, and he's awesome. And he did just that. He started a Bitcoin club. And I would say, if you're out of college, start a Bitcoin meetup in your area, right? Like, start being like me, claim you're an expert, even though you're not, and just start spreading the good word.
I love it. Thank you so much, Lisa. Really appreciate your time. It's been a blast.
Yeah. Thank you. You're great.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you did, do me a huge favor, subscribe to our channel or podcast, give us a like, share it with someone who you think might be interested in it. Would really, really appreciate all of your support. Go check out Lisa's website, get in touch with her if you feel so inclined. And of course, if you want to properly self-custody your Bitcoin the right way, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We'll walk you through that process. I was a client before I worked with the team. I can vouch for the unbelievable care that they take when they're helping you. You can also set up a privacy phone. We'll walk you through that. We can help you set up your online privacy. So whether you're connecting via mobile devices or your laptop, or your desktop, protected. And if you need a Plan B residency option, we have that for you as well. Again, thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We'd love to talk with you. In the meantime, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.